Lecture 2, The Fundamentals of Supply and Demand.
The next 9 lectures are going to be lectures in microeconomics. So they're going to look at from the bottom up at the economy. In beginning to launch into microeconomics, it's useful to have some sort of overall vision of the microeconomy and how we think about it. And a useful tool for thinking about that is what economists sometimes call a circular flow diagram. To think about a circular flow diagram, imagine that there are 2 main actors in the economy, or really sets of actors. One set of actors is the households in the economy, sort of individuals acting as households. And the other set of actors are the firms in the economy, all the businesses that are out there. And let's imagine that these 2 sets of actors, of economic actors, households and firms, are interacting in 3 different markets. One is a market for goods, one is a market for labor, and one is a market for capital. Let's think about each of these markets briefly in turn. In the goods market, firms are producing the goods and the services as well, and they are supplying those things into the goods market. Households, on the other hand, are demanding the goods out of the goods market. If you think about labor, the reverse is true. Households are supplying labor. They supply labor with their decisions to work. Firms, on the other hand, are the ones who demand labor. They want to get the labor and use it for production purposes. In the capital market, most useful way to think of it typically is to think of people as supplying capital when they save money. So they supply capital when they put money in your bank account or when you invest in one way or another. And then when firms borrow money for investment purposes, they are demanding that capital and using it to invest in one way or another. Now, if you imagine that whole diagram, see that whole diagram with the arrows showing the demand and the supply and the goods flowing around, you can imagine that the economy is a circular flow where households are providing the labor and the capital that's being used by the firms to produce goods, and then the goods are going back to the households, and the economy just flows in this enormous circle. What we want to do is first focus in the next couple of lectures on the goods market. We'll focus on the goods market, and then we'll spend 2 lectures on that, then a lecture on the labor market, and 2 lectures on the capital market. So we'll systematically work our way through this circular flow diagram, looking at each individual market. Then we'll spend the last 4 lectures of the microeconomic sequence talking about what can go wrong in markets. And in particular, we'll focus on pollution and poverty, problems of monopoly, problems of imperfect information in markets, problems of research and development and education. In all these cases, there are going to be firm reasons to believe that self-interest in markets may not provide exactly what we'd like it to provide, and there's room for government to come in and make some sort of adjustment to improve matters. But thinking about exactly why things go wrong and exactly what adjustment would be best is the stuff that economists work on. Now, the notion here is to go through these things systematically. The notion is to work through the markets and work through the problems. Remember again that the notion of a whole lecture or a course in economics is not to give you answers or to focus in on particular policy issues in a close way, but instead to give you an idea of the structure of how economists think. And this structure of markets and problems with markets is what you'll see in just about any economics treatment that you start off with. As a starting point for talking about markets, let's talk about prices. We've talked about prices a few times in the first lecture already. Prices are an incentive. They're a reason to act in certain ways, that you might buy more of something or buy less of something, depending on the price. We also know that prices somehow come out of exchange, that there's a buyer and a seller, and in some way or another, they agree on a price. Both sides, if one agrees to buy and one agrees to sell, must see that trade as beneficial. So there are gains from that trade to both sides. But none of that explains where do the prices actually come from in the first place. Where are the prices? What's their source? To non-economists, prices are typically value-laden. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that you really hear non-economists a lot of the time say things like, well, you know, nurses, they aren't paid enough. Teachers, they aren't paid enough. On the other hand, professional athletes, they're paid too much. Politicians are paid too much. And those judgments, paid too little, paid too much, are value judgments. They're judgments that what I see happening in the world in terms of pay people are receiving doesn't fit with some set of values I have, with some set of judgments about people and what I'd like them to do. Adam Smith, in 1776, in his great book, The Wealth of Nations,
presented what he called the diamond water paradox. And the diamond water paradox is basically an argument that this connection between value and prices is something that economists should stay away from. That we shouldn't expect value to show up as prices. We shouldn't expect prices to represent our values. That we should take those two things and we should section them off as being separate. Smith's diamond water paradox goes something like this. Let's think about the two goods, diamonds and water. Well, first of all, diamonds. What's the value of diamonds? Well, at the time Smith is writing, they didn't really use diamonds for industrial purposes like drill bits and stuff like that. Diamonds were really just for jewelry. So here you had this just for jewelry. I mean, in terms of sheer frivolousness, it's hard to imagine a good more frivolous than diamonds in 1776. Yes, they're pretty. They have no other function. Water, on the other hand, when you think about its value, I mean, you die if you don't get water. It's hard to imagine something more fundamental than water. So why is it, Smith said, that diamonds, the good with essentially no redeeming value except frivolousness, are extraordinarily expensive and hardly anyone can afford them? Whereas water, a good which is extraordinarily important and everyone needs it every day, is so cheap that a lot of the time you're not charged for it at all. Value and price are clearly very separate. Smith's answer to that question was, well, value and price are different things. And what determines price is not value in some gut level, is it meaningful, does it count, does it represent values I care about sense. What matters is supply and demand. The reason diamonds are expensive is because there aren't very many of them. They're scarce. The reason water is cheap is there's lots of water. In England, it falls out of the sky all the time. Now, we can, of course, imagine situations like if you were dying of dehydration in the desert, where you might say, well, I would be willing in that situation to trade diamonds for water. But again, that's just a situation of supply and demand and how things work out, whether something is scarce or not. So Smith said this whole notion that we should expect prices to be value-laden is something that we should try and get away from. We shouldn't let it govern our thinking. In fact, we should discipline ourselves not to expect that to be true. Oscar Wilde wrote in Lady Windermere's Fan, one of his less well-known plays, "A cynic is somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing." Economists have adopted that comment, except we now refer to it as an economist is somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Now, I mean that in a serious way. Economists know prices. We know what determines prices. We know what makes them go up and down. We do not know values. We do not know that one thing should be more or should be less than something else. From an economist's point of view, we know chicken soup is cheaper than chicken cordon bleu. We don't know it's better or less good. We know that a pro basketball player is paid more than a high school teacher. We don't know anything about the respective value of those two people. All we know is prices. We don't know values. And I think that a lot of the time, we get into terrible problems when we start trying to use prices to infer value, as if someone who was paid more was a better human being, or something silly like that. Prices are just supply and demand, and all we're going to be talking about, really, is prices and what determines them. Now, I've said supply and demand 3, 4, 5 different times. What do economists actually mean by supply and demand? What I want to try and do here, although it's a little bit dry, I recognize, is to build up a base of understanding of what's really meant by these fundamental terms. Let's start off by talking about demand, and then we'll talk about supply. What do economists mean by demand? Demand is a relationship, first of all. Demand is a relationship between price and the quantity of a good that's demanded. As the price goes up and up, the quantity demanded will be lower and lower. It's often useful to imagine this as being something on a graph, where you imagine the horizontal axis as being quantity and the vertical axis as being price. So as the price goes up and up, the quantity demanded goes down and down, and you can imagine demand sort of sloping down on that kind of a graph. Why is that? Why is it that demand slopes down? Why is it that as the price goes up, the quantity demanded of most things drops? Well, almost to ask that question is to answer it in a way. I I think that for most of us, there's sort of an intuitive notion. If you're buying something and the price of it goes up and up, you know, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to try and, you know, make do with a little bit less and transfer your money elsewhere. Economists have taken that intuition and formalized it a little bit, and they give two particular reasons for why you're likely to buy less of the good. One they call the substitution reason is that as the price goes up and up, people are going to buy less of it because they'll substitute other goods and they'll try and get satisfaction buying other things. The second reason is called the income effect, and the income effect is just that as the price of something goes up and up, if you think about it, you might have to buy less of it, whether you really want to or not, because after all, you can't afford to just keep buying it as the price goes higher and higher. You'll run out of money. So you'll be forced by the fact that you have a limited amount of income to buy somewhat less of that good and maybe of some other goods as well. Now, how much is it going to be true that as the price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down? Well, the answer there, of course, is that it's different according to every product. We can imagine some product, like, say, if you're a diabetic who needs insulin in order to manage the disease, then as the price of insulin goes up, you're probably not going to cut back a whole lot. You really need that insulin, and so you're going to do everything you can as long as you can afford it in order to be able to keep buying it. On the other hand, you can imagine some products, like, say, expensive steak, where if the price of expensive steak goes up, hey, people can buy less expensive steak, they can buy hamburger, they can buy chicken, they can buy pork. And so there's a lot of ways to substitute away, and you might see a lot of decline in the price, in the quantity demanded as the price goes up. So that question of how much does the quantity change, we're going to have to determine that on the basis of every individual good, depending on what the substitutes are and depending how easy it is to switch away. Now, that may all sound straightforward enough. Let me then ask you what's intended to be a trick question. So, since it's a trick question, you shouldn't worry too much about not getting it right the first time. What is it that makes demand rise or fall? And the trick question is that the answer is not price. Now, why is that not the answer? Demand, remember, is a relationship between price and quantity demanded. Demand already includes within it a whole range of different possible prices and a whole range of different quantities demanded. That's all included within the concept of what demand is. So when we talk about demand shifting, what we need to talk about is at every possible price, more will be demanded or less will be demanded. In other words, the entire relationship between price and quantity demanded is going to have to move. At every single price, more could be demanded, or at every single price, less could be demanded. Now, what are some of the things which would cause that to happen, which would cause demand to shift, so that at every single price, more would be demanded or less would be demanded? Well, one obvious example over time would be, say that income for the whole society goes up. Well, if income for the whole society goes up, everyone's got more money, then we would expect that any given price, more would be bought than before. Similarly, in a recession, if incomes are going down, then we might expect demand to decrease. At any given price, less would be purchased. Another example, say population goes up over time. Well, if there are just more people in the economy, then at any given price, we would expect a greater quantity to be demanded. If we had some terrible problem like the Black Plague or some terrible disease or disaster, the population went down, then you would expect demand to shift in such a way that at any given price, less would be demanded. A couple of other examples. One would be fads or just tastes, shifts in tastes. If you have a society like the one we're living in where people are buying more chicken and less beef, or they're buying more wine and beer and less hard alcohol, we would expect those tastes to show up that as time goes on, we are buying more at any given price, then the quantity demanded is going to be higher. If tastes shift the other direction, then at any given price, the level of quantity demanded will be lower. A final example, which is always worth remembering, is that sometimes when we're thinking about demand for one particular good, it will be affected not by its own price, because its own price is already taken into account in demand, but by the price of other goods. So, for example, let's think about demand for beef. If the price of chicken goes way down, that could easily affect the demand for beef. Because after all, as the price of chicken goes way down and people start buying more chicken, they have more of an incentive to buy chicken, then at any given price, the amount of beef purchased will decline. So when we think about demand rising and falling, we want to think about these factors like income, like population, like tastes, like prices of other goods. But the price of the good itself is built into what economists mean by demand. Demand is a relationship. It's not a quantity or a single amount. Let's think about supply. And I hope some of this sounds familiar because supply and demand are of course related closely to each other. When we think about supply, we again want to think about supply as a relationship. We want to think about it this time as a relationship between price and the quantity supplied. And in general, that relationship is that the higher the price, the greater the quantity will be supplied. You can again visualize that on a graph, if that's helpful. Typically, the graph has quantity on the horizontal axis. It has price on the vertical axis. And as price goes up, the quantity is also going to be going up. And so the result of that will be that the supply curve is sort of stretching up, reaching upward, sloping upward. Why is it that a higher price leads to a higher quantity supplied? Well, it sounds a little technical put that way, but again, if you just think about it on an intuitive basis, it ought to make some sense to you. If the price of something went up and up, and you were making that product, would you make more of it or less of it? Well, a higher price gives you an opportunity to make more money. It's going to encourage you to try and expand your production. It also might attract new producers who would be coming into the market with the thought that they could produce more and expand, and that also would have the effect of expanding production. So at some intuitive level, it should make sense, I think, that as the price goes up, that gives more incentive for people to come into the market and provide more. How much more? As a price goes up, how much more are people going to produce? Well, just as with demand, that amount is going to vary product by product. If we think about a product, for example, which is Van Gogh paintings, and we say, well, as the price of Van Gogh paintings goes up, how many more are going to be produced? The answer is pretty much zero, because Vincent is dead, and so we don't expect more paintings. On the other hand, we might expect a whole lot more calendars, posters, prints, and other things that are done in the Van Gogh style, but those are other goods, other related markets. Flip side is, if we took our example of pencils a little while ago, and we said, well, let's imagine that the price of a pencil doubles. How many more pencils can be produced? Boy, I mean, with just a little bit of time for retooling the factories and stuff, I bet we could all be waist deep in pencils in not very much time at all. There's some goods where I think it's quite possible to adjust in a relatively short period and produce a lot more of good very quickly. But again, that will just depend on the different goods, how easy it is to adjust production over time, and it, of course, will take a little time often to adjust and produce more of something. Now, let me again ask you the trick question that I asked before. I hope it's not as tricky this time. What is it that makes supply rise or fall? And the answer is not price. Price, remember, is already built into what we mean by supply. There's a full range of prices, and what supply tells you is, at any of these given prices, how much will be supplied, what quantity will be supplied at each of those prices. So movements in price don't change supply, they just move you up and down a supply curve, if you want to think of it in that way. Supply is a force. It tells you, at any given price, how much will be supplied, what quantity. So if we want to shift supply, we need an external force, a force which will mean that at any given price, a greater quantity will be supplied, or at any given price, a lesser quantity will be supplied. What are some examples of forces like that? Well, one force is new technology. If you have new technology, then at any given price, it can be cheaper to produce than it was before. And so at any given selling price, you'll produce more than you did before. For a lot of farm products, the weather may be something that affects supply. If there's terrible, terrible weather, then at any given price, there will be less of that farm product on the market than before. Government regulation is something that can often affect supply. If government regulations raise the cost of production, then in a way, it's kind of like the government version of bad weather, that really high regulatory costs mean that for any given price, the company will supply less than they did before. And a final general thought would be the price of inputs going into something. If inputs get cheaper, then at any given price for the output, the company would be willing to produce more. For example, if the price of steel went way down, then at any given price, car companies would be willing to produce more cars. So the price of the good itself is already included in supply, but the price of inputs can affect the supply curve and make it shift in one direction or another. Now comes one of these moments of transcendental joy and beauty for all economists. Let's think about supply and demand not separately but together. Let's put them in our minds on a single graph. Let's think about how that graph works. At a very low price for any given good, what would we expect to happen? Well, at a very low price, we would expect suppliers are not very enthusiastic about providing the product, so the quantity supplied is going to be low. However, at a very low price, we would also expect that a lot of people would be willing to buy it, since it's cheap, and so the quantity demanded might be very high. The quantity demanded will be higher than the quantity supplied. There'll be a lot of people wanting to buy, not so many wanting to sell. Now, let's think about a high price. At a high price, you can switch all those things around. At a high price, the quantity supplied is going to be very high. Because after all, at a high price, people are going to be eager to supply more of the product. However, the quantity demanded is going to be low because, after all, at a very high price, people are going to be trying to substitute away, buy other things, and so on, conserve on purchasing the product. So, somewhere in the middle, these two forces balance out. You can kind of imagine that as the price goes up and up and up, people are willing to supply more and more, but they demand less and less and less. And at some point, the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied cross. They balance each other out. And quantity demand and quantity supplied are equal to each other. Now that magical point, that price where quantity demanded is equal to quantity supplied, is called equilibrium. Now, what does equilibrium really mean? It's useful to think of equilibrium, I think, as a sort of a balance, and to think about it as the place where the balance is pushed to over time. Think, for example, again, about the situation of what happens if the price is below equilibrium, if the price is very low to begin with. As we talked about a little bit before, at a very low price, people who demand that product are going to be thrilled to pieces. After all, it's really, really cheap. They're going to rush out to buy it. People who supply the product, on the other hand, are not going to be very cheerful at all. They don't like the low price. They don't want to produce very much. So as a result, there are going to be people waiting in lines. There are going to be lots of people trying to buy the product and not able to get it because there aren't very many suppliers out there. Now, what happens in that situation? Well, of course what would happen. I mean, if you were running a store and you had lines and lines of people lined up to buy your product, what do? You raise the price. Somebody raises the price. And as that price gradually moves up, suppliers are willing to supply more, the demanders begin to trim back, and we head toward a situation where the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded balance out, where they're equal to each other. So think about that whole thing in reverse for a moment. So think about the situation where we have, start off with a price that's just too high to begin with. It's extremely high and above the equilibrium level. What happens in that situation? Well, in that situation with a very high price, suppliers are really eager to provide the product. So they produce lots and lots of it. Demanders, on the other hand, not so eager. They're not willing to buy very much. So what happens? Suppliers are producing a lot. Not very much is getting bought. It's building up. More and more is getting produced. You can imagine this product piling up on store shelves, piling up, getting higher and higher, and it's not being sold. So what happens in that situation? Well, if you're a seller of that product, you're going to have to cut the price. You want to ditch what's on your shelves. You want to reduce that amount. So you would expect the price to gradually start coming down. And as it gradually starts coming down, the suppliers will be less eager to provide it. The demanders will be willing to soak up some of that extra and generally will work toward a place where supply and demand are equal to each other. So equilibrium is just the place where things are stable. If when the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded are equal to each other, there's no reason for suppliers to supply more or less. Everyone who wants to supply at that price is able to supply what they want. Everyone who wants to buy at that price can buy all they want at that price. There's no big lines, there's no shortages, there's no surpluses. Everything's in balance. So that's all that's meant by the idea of equilibrium. An equilibrium is stable in that sense. An equilibrium is also efficient in the way that economists use the term. When economists refer to something as being efficient, it's useful, I think, to think of a machine and what you think of by an efficient machine. An efficient machine doesn't have a lot of squeaking. It doesn't have a lot of friction. It doesn't have a lot of extra parts. It doesn't have a lot of wasted motion. In the same way, an efficient market at equilibrium is a market which doesn't have lines. It doesn't have shortages. It doesn't have surpluses piling up. It doesn't have wasted motion. Everything that's produced gets bought. And the price allows everyone to get what they want at that given price. The equilibrium also tells you something about where the gains from trade come from. Think about, again, supply and demand for a moment. There are some suppliers out there, not many, but a few, who would have been willing to supply at a very, very low price. But because they get to sell at the market price, at the equilibrium price, they get what seems to them a really good deal. They get to sell for more than they would have been willing to. In the same way, on the demand side of the market, there are a few demanders out there, not many, but some, who would have been willing to buy at a very, very high price. But in the market, they don't have to pay the very, very high price. They just have to pay the market price. And so you can sort of think of the market as bringing together people who would be willing to pay more than the market price and sellers who would be willing to produce for the less than the market price. These people come together and they're able to all buy and sell at one given price. They all benefit from that exchange. So an equilibrium is both stable and as economists use the term, it's efficient. I would again say that doesn't mean it's good. It doesn't mean it's perfect. It doesn't mean that it's always desirable. But it does tell you something about where we're headed there. Now, this idea of the market, and how it balances out, is something that requires a little further explanation. Because for almost everyone, when they head into this idea of what the market is, they immediately think, okay, I understand this idea that things will balance out, that, you know, you won't have big shortages, you won't have big surpluses, but, you know, is this good? Is this what we want? What are the limitations of this way of looking at the world? And there are a number of limitations that are really important to think about. First key limitation is that when I say a market is efficient, or a market reaches equilibrium, or a market balances out supply and demand, in no way do I mean that the equilibrium makes everybody happy. Think about it for a moment. There's always going to be people in the market on the demand side who would like to buy the product if only it were cheaper. And those people are always going to look at the equilibrium price and they're always going to say, you know, I don't care if it's equilibrium. I don't like it. The price is too high. I would be willing to buy more, but that price is ridiculous. If the price were lower, I would buy more of it. And they're right. If the price was lower, they would buy more of it. Many people would buy more of it. And those people are going to complain. They're going to go to their congressmen, they're going to go to their local legislators, and they're going to say that price is unfair and it ought to be moved. They're not going to be happy just because it's an equilibrium or it's efficient. Exactly the same is going to be true on the supply side of the market. There are always going to be suppliers out there who say, yeah, I understand that that's the equilibrium price or that's the market price, but that's not a fair price. That's not a good price. It's not the right price for society. And the suppliers will tend to say things like, you know, if the price was higher, we could create more jobs. We could build our local economy. We could build the economy if only that price was higher. If we would just pass a law keeping that price high and preventing those nasty price declines, then, you know, we would be a stronger company. We would have a stronger economy. We would have a stronger future. And they'll be right in the sense that if the price was higher, yes, that particular company would be happier. If the price was higher, that particular company would be delighted to produce more than they were producing. So anytime you look at a market, there are going to be some people who are happy. The people who made trades in the market, the people who feel better off. There's also going to be a large number of people, both demanders and suppliers, who are always unhappy. And those unhappy people are going to go to their congressmen and complain, and you're going to see them in the papers, and, you know, Joe is going to stand up and say, I just can't afford this, and companies are going to go up and say, we just can't manage to make a living this way. So when you think about a market, you think about what works, there's no reason to expect everyone to be happy with it, none whatsoever. A second notion about markets and equilibrium and the limits to it. Prices in the market, you notice, are not set by the producers. Producers in a market don't just go out there and say, this is what I want to charge today. Producers face, in a supply and demand framework, at least two big problems. One problem is, what are all of my competitors going to charge? And if you have all your competitors out there in the market, you can't just charge whatever you want. If you charge more than everybody else, then customers are going to go other places. You'll lose business. You won't be able to make money. So this notion that, you know, the landlord just sets the price, or one company just sets the price, or one bank just sets the price, is not going to be true in a competitive market. It's going to be true that everyone competing against everyone else sets the price. And if you've run a business yourself, if you know someone who runs a business, you know that people are deeply constrained when you run a business by what the competition is doing. You don't have free will here. You have to think about what the competition is doing and react to it, and think about the other ways people could spend their money. Even if you were a business that has a pure monopoly, and there aren't very many of those, but even if you had no competition because you have a monopoly in your product, you still have to worry about the demand side of the market. Because unless you have a monopoly where everyone will continue to buy your product no matter what, it would be like having a monopoly on insulin and the whole world is diabetic. So the whole world has to buy your product no matter what, and they can't switch. That just, you know, that doesn't happen very often. With almost every other product I can think of, and certainly every real world product of any importance, even if you had a monopoly, you would have to worry about the fact that as you raise your price, people would seek out different ways of doing things. Even if you had a monopoly on all the oil in the world, if you were to raise the price, people can insulate their homes, they can drive less, they can drive fuel-efficient cars. They have a variety of ways of buying less of your product. And so when we think about who sets the price, supply and demand gives us a sort of a complicated answer. It's not set by individual demanders. It's not set by individual suppliers. It's set with people having pressure on them from outside, where competitors have to meet their competition, where people have to deal with the other demanders and the other suppliers in the market. A third complaint about this whole framework, and I'm sure it's a complaint that occurred to more than one of you while I was sort of trying to describe supply and demand. The complaint is, this is way too theoretical. This is theoretical, and in fact, because it's theoretical, it's a little bit silly. After all, I don't draw these curves. I don't sit down and say, I'm going to the grocery store. What does my demand for milk look like? How has my income changed? Does my demand curve move? Business people aren't out there saying, well, you know, before I open up my little store this morning, I have to draw a supply curve on the wall and figure out what's going to happen. This framework seems out of place. It seems like it's out there in Never Never Land. It seems like it's floating somewhere. And how can anything like that really describe the real world? I think that complaint has force, but it also is at some deep level fundamentally a wrong way of thinking about what academia does and what thinking about social problems should try and do. Let me give you an analogy. Let's think for a moment about a quarterback on a football team. And let's say this quarterback is a very accurate passer. And that quarterback can, standing there at one spot, throw a ball 50 yards downfield and hit someone who's running across the field in the other direction. And the quarterback can do that with extraordinary accuracy. They can do that time after time after time after time. Now, imagine you went to a physicist and you said to that physicist, I'm going to give you a problem. We have a 220-pound human being who is going to throw a ball of a certain weight 50 yards downfield in this direction while another person runs across the field, and I want you to calculate the force and trajectory of the throw that will go up in the air, will launch the ball down, and will hit the person at that spot as they intersect going across the field. The physicist could do that. It's not even a particularly complicated problem in physics terms to figure out what the force and spin, and they could adjust for friction, they could adjust for wind, they could adjust for all kinds of things. Now, imagine you take that set of equations that the physicist drew up for you, and you go back to the quarterback, and you say to the quarterback, hi, this is your set of equations. This is what you did. Could the quarterback draw up that set of equations? Well, most of the time, let's say no. I mean, most of the time, the quarterback would have no ability to say, yes, you know, I can sketch out the physics of throwing the ball. All the quarterback can do is throw the ball. Now, in much the same way, economists view themselves as standing back from consumers and standing back from firms and describing what they do, even though people themselves are just out there throwing the ball. You may not draw individual demand curves. You'll be very a weird person if you do. But that doesn't mean that when you go to the grocery with your own self-interest and you shop and you go up and down stores and you pick things out, that you are not just as expert in that with long lifetimes of practice as a football quarterback is in throwing a ball downfield. And to say, well, you know, I don't draw demand curves has no force. Your behavior could still be described by this pattern quite well, even if you personally couldn't draw it up on a blackboard. Similarly, if you think about business people, you think about business people doing things, yes, most people, particularly small business people, don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm part of a supply curve. I need to think about how my supply curve works. All they do is run their business. But you run your business day in, day out. You get a lot of practice running your business. You are the equivalent of that football quarterback passing the ball over and over and over again. And someone else could come along from the outside and say, hey, this is what you're doing. It is represented by this diagram. And they could be right, even if that diagram had never occurred to you or if you had no capability to do that diagram. So this argument that it's too theoretical, it doesn't work, it doesn't make sense because people don't think that way, I think is actually an argument with really zero force. The actual question is not, does it work in the sense that people actually draw up diagrams in that way? The interesting question is, does it work in the sense that it explains the world around us? Does it work in the sense that it's a useful framework for talking about these issues and that it gives us some interesting insights? And if those things are true, then the rest of it, of whether people actually do it or not, is not a relevant question. In fact, I heard a more cynical answer to this question of, this is all too theoretical, it's not what businesses do, it's not what people do, from a professor at a business school recently who said, it darn well is what business people do. And how do we know that? Because it's what we taught them in business school. So, I mean, more and more people have taken economics courses. They have business degrees. They're out there running businesses. You say this is not what they do. Heck, it's what they were trained to do. It's what they were taught to do. And so I think at that level, it certainly is what people do. A fourth objection, this supply and demand framework. And it's the notion that there's an equilibrium and an efficient equilibrium, balances out quantity supplied and quantity demanded, is, okay, yeah, markets do that. But I don't like the outcome of markets. For example, markets might produce things like pornography, like prostitution, like drug dealing, like heavily sugar-frosted cereals that rot children's teeth, like junk food. Markets might focus more on hair loss and impotence for men than on curing diseases that affect poor children. There could be a lot of things about markets that a person is not particularly enthusiastic about, because after all the market is doing is setting quantity supplied and quantity demanded equal at a certain price. The market is not thinking in some broad sense about social needs and desires, about justice, or about anything else. The answer to this is relatively blunt. You don't like it? Fine. I don't like it a lot of the time. A lot of people don't like it. Supply and demand is not about what you like. Supply and demand is not an argument that says this outcome is one which you have to like. Supply and demand is just a way of thinking about how these different forces balance off against one another. And in thinking about how the different forces balance off against one another, how the market produces what people in the end really want. There are a couple of interesting ways of thinking about this. One is, I've heard people say that what the market is really about is, the term that's sometimes used is consumer sovereignty. It provides what people want. Consumers are sovereign. Now, we may not like it that people want prostitution or drugs or various things, but the market is not about what you like. It's about what consumers like. And if there are people who want to provide something, well, so be it. Another way of putting the same point that I've sometimes heard is that the market is about market transactions between consenting adults. And if things are between consenting adults, the marketplace does not step in and say, well, you may be a consenting adult, but I don't like what you're consenting to. I don't like what you're purchasing. I don't like what you're selling. The market simply allows consenting adults to meet and make the transactions that they want to make, for better or for worse. And that'll be something we'll need to come back to as we talk about the market. The next lecture is really going to focus in on policy and how we deal with some of these issues of disliking what the market produces or doesn't produce. But the bottom line I want to emphasize here is that the market framework works. I say that so quickly, and I feel like the impact of it somehow doesn't quite come through. But the market framework, this supply and demand idea, works. It works as a way of explaining how prices change and how quantities change. It works not only in the contemporary United States, but it works well applied to historical cases. It works well historical cases in the United States back into the 18th century, the 17th century, back as far as we can reach. Not only that, it works quite well if we think about other countries, and not just European countries or Western countries. It works well if we talk about the prices of goods in Africa or in China or in Latin America. It works not only in those countries, but it works in their history as well. If you're trying to explain why prices go up and down, why quantities go up and down, in the goods market, in the capital market, in the labor market, you just over and over and over are driven back to supply and demand as the way of thinking about it. Because that framework, simple as it may be, provides an ongoing structure which allows you to explain those things over and over and over. And in future lectures, I'll be giving example after example after example. The point of all that, again, is that this may seem unfamiliar, but its unfamiliarity should not be taken as something which puts you off or causes you to step aside from economics. Instead, the unfamiliarity should be in some sense exciting, because these tools of economics, these ways of looking at the world, this structure, this apparatus, this method of thinking, is all a way which illuminates many things which could otherwise be puzzling about the world we live in.